Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
During and in furtherance of his candidacy for president, the defendant and others agreed to identify and suppress negative stories about him. Two parties to this agreement have admitted to committing illegal conduct in connection with the scheme. In August 2018, Lawyer A pleaded guilty to two federal crimes involving illegal campaign contributions and subsequently served time in prison. In addition, in August 2018, America Media Inc., AMI, a media company that owned and published magazines and supermarket tabloids, including the National Enquirer, admitted in a non-prosecution agreement that it made a payment to a source of a story to ensure that the source, quote, did not publicize damaging allegations, unquote, about the defendant, quote, before the 2016 presidential election and thereby influence that election, unquote.
That's the voice of acclaimed actor Glenn Close reading from the New York Statement of Facts that was filed by the district attorney in Manhattan along with the New York indictment that we heard read by Robert De Niro just the other day. Here's a bit more concerning a meeting at Trump Tower from that other preeminent actor, Robert De Niro.
From the Statement of Facts, the scheme, the 2015 Trump Tower meeting. In June 2015, the defendant announced his candidacy for President of the United States. Soon after, in August 2015, the defendant met with Lawyer A and AMI's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, the AMI CEO, at Trump Tower in New York County. At the meeting, the AMI CEO agreed to help with the defendant's campaigns, saying that he would act as the eyes and ears for the campaign by looking out for negative stories about the defendant and alerting Lawyer A before the stories were published. The AMI CEO also agreed to publish negative stories about the defendant's competitors for the election.
Hi, and welcome to Prosecuting Donald Trump. It is Thursday, April 18th, late in the afternoon at, I believe, 5:11 p.m. You know, Mary, we're now actually giving exact times. This is how much, like, minute by minute, so much is changing. But in any event, I am, as you all know, joined by my wonderful co-host, Mary McCord.
Hi, Andrew. For me, it is 2:11 p.m. because I am on the West Coast. So I had my first recorded interview at 7:30 a.m. this morning.
You'd be impressed to know that I was guest teaching a class this morning at 8:30.
Ooh, I am impressed.
Which, you know, for a DC person, you're probably like, so what? You know, we get up at 5. But for a native New Yorker, basically functioning before 10 a.m. is hard, especially at my age. But in any event, there's so much going on and there's a lot to cover. So, Mary, what's up?
Yeah, so we're going to hear more from Glenn Close and Robert De Niro throughout this episode. We're going to break down the portions of the statement of facts that they are going to read, and we're going to kind of explain how that relates to what we expect to see in the trial. But before that, right now, like you said, 5:11, the court, we understand, in Manhattan now has 12 jurors selected.
12 jurors and one alternate. So Friday morning, we're going to have the court picking the other 5 alternate jurors. So there'll be 12 jurors, 6 alternates. That's a large number of alternates for a trial, totally appropriate in a case like this. You do not want to run out of jurors. Remember, we've already seen 2 jurors drop out, and that sort of relates to the second thing, which is that I think for people who are following the show, they're aware of a pending motion by the district attorney with respect to violations of the gag order issued by Judge Mershon and they raised new alleged violations related to violations of the gag order with respect to jurors. That's something that's going to be heard by the court on Tuesday. We will certainly want to hear from Donald Trump's counsel. We've talked about this, that they're entitled to due process, so we'll be covering that as well. But that is the latest. And the reason I'm raising that is that two of the jurors who seem to have been selected and were sort of going to be sitting jurors have dropped out. One appears to be because of new information, but one because she was concerned about her being able to be fair in light of, she said, her identity was too outed. And so she was getting too many calls and just didn't want that pressure. I have to say, Mary, it reminds me in a very different context of sort of Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, that this sort of people who are just trying to do their service, just trying to be public servants, just trying to do their jury service, in their case, being poll workers, being subject to attacks. It is very much a sign of our times. But what we were looking for is how the judge responds to this and what precautions he ends up taking to potentially sequester the jury in some fashion or to have them escorted by marshals or court officers, whether there's sanctions with respect to Donald Trump. All of that are tools that he has in his toolkit to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't interfere with the jury and also the selection of jurors, that this kind of attack isn't being used in a manipulative way as a means for Trump or his allies to target some of the jurors who they may think may not be favorable to them.
Right. And I just want to pull these two things apart, because the concerns about potential violations of the gag order were with respect to new social media posts by Donald Trump about potential jurors. The two jurors that were dismissed, I don't think said that it had anything to do with, you know, that social media post or any attacks they've had by Mr. Trump to them personally. But one juror, and here I'm going to do a little bit of a I told you so, because not you, Andrew, but like I told you so to the world.
As, you do those privately.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Because, you know, as we discussed earlier this week, I was pretty shocked to see that in this voir dire procedure, they were going to have the jurors answering these questions loudly and clearly from their seats in the jury box with everyone in the courtroom and including journalists in the overflow courtroom hearing those, because some of those answers I thought could potentially reveal the identity of jurors, even though their names were not being disclosed. These were things like, who is your employer? Who is your former employer? What area of Manhattan do you live in? And I think that's exactly what came to pass. The woman this morning who just said, you know, I'm nervous because I've had friends say I can be identified now by that information and I no longer feel comfortable. What that triggered, to your point of things that the judge can do to try to address not only Trump's statements on social media that may violate the gag order, but also to address this issue of juror identities and jurors feeling safe and feel like they can come and do their civic duty without it resulting in threats to their safety, is he said to the journalists, no more reporting on everything that you're hearing, no more reporting on their employers or former employers, and no more reporting on what you're seeing, like describing them, what they look like, what they're wearing, etc. And it's something that I think, you know, I wish he would have done that at the beginning, to be honest with you, but I'm glad that he responded that way now, because there was a lot of reporting after the first and second day of jury selection with great detail about the various jurors.
It also goes to show you, although Manhattan's a big place, you know, the internet is even bigger, so that you can sort of end up getting a lot of those details.
That's right.
But Mary, let's turn to what we just heard about, and we're about to hear some more from Robert De Niro on the allegations. What we were hearing about from, can I say, Glenn and Bob?
We're on a first name basis with them.
Yeah, well, this is like show three for
That's true.
So the allegations are that Michael Cohen and David Pecker, that is the person who's not named, but there's sort of lawyer A is Michael Cohen. There's a reference to the owner and publisher of American Media, AMI, that's the owner of the National Enquirer. Those two people have admitted their participation in this catch and kill scheme. And they, as we talked about on the last episode, are going to talk, according to the DA, not just about sort of catch and kill only with respect to Stormy Daniels, but a panoply of ways in which they were both catching and killing. And they were also part of a scheme where there was dissemination of false information about adversaries. But that is the gist of what we were just hearing about. And the rest of what we're going to talk about are sort of key parts of the statement of facts that lay out for the public and give us a bit of a roadmap from the DA's perspective of the chief pieces of evidence that's about the nature of the scheme, all done, as alleged, on behalf of candidate Trump. And just to channel Nicole Wallace, her point is, gee, you know, Michael Cohen is not the person who was running for office. David Pecker was not the person who was running for office. Neither of them were the people who were having derogatory information about their alleged sexual escapades being suppressed. It's all clearly being done, according to these allegations, for one person.
That's right.
And that is the candidate who is running for office. So they have already admitted their liability.
Yeah, let's be clear. They have pleaded guilty. Well, not they.
Well, Michael Cohen has pleaded guilty. David Pecker has admitted his liability.
That's right.
In an agreement.
In an agreement with prosecutors, right?
Absolutely. So the subtext is really, they're the ones who are supposed to only admit their liability, but the person who it's for is not liable. That is a theme that I think you are going to hear from the DA's office from opening to closing.
That's right. And on that note, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we will hear more of the statement of facts. We'll hear about suppressing the account of Karen McDougal.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about
work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome back. As promised, we'll now hear another excerpt read by Robert De Niro that concerns the attempt to suppress Karen McDougal's story.
Suppressing Woman One's account. About 5 months before the presidential election, in or about June 2016, the editor-in-chief of the National Enquirer and AMI's chief content officer, the AMI editor-in-chief, contacted Lawyer A about a woman, Woman One, who alleged she had a sexual relationship with a defendant while he was married. The AMI editor-in-chief updated Lawyer A regularly about the matter over text message and by telephone. The defendant did not want this information to become public because he was concerned about the effect it could have on his candidacy. Thereafter, the defendant, the AMI CEO, and Lawyer A had a series of discussions about who should pay off Woman One to secure her silence. AMI ultimately paid $150,000 to Woman One in exchange for her agreement not to speak out about the alleged sexual relationship, as well as for two magazine cover features of Woman One and a series of articles that would be published under her byline. AMI falsely characterized this payment in AMI's books and records, including in its general ledger. The AMI CEO agreed to the deal after discussing with both the defendant and Lawyer A, and on the understanding from Lawyer A that the defendant or the Trump Organization would reimburse AMI.
So, Andrew, I think it's worth, you know, we talked before the break about the catch and kill scheme, and this was an integral part of that. And in fact, this is not the only part that the jurors are going to hear. They are also probably going to hear from a person referred to in the indictment as the doorman, because even before the catching and killing the Karen McDougal story, there was another account of a story potentially about the doorman at one of Mr. Trump's properties who had heard information that he had reported also that would reflect negatively on Mr. Trump about another type of sexual encounter. Well, actually, specifically, let's just be clear here. It was that the doorman wanted to sell information regarding a child that Mr. Trump had allegedly fathered out of wedlock. So that information is other information that is going to come in front of the jury to start to show what this catch and kill operation really meant. And then the next account, before we even get to Stormy Daniels, will be this account of Karen McDougal. And I will say that Mr. Trump, in a motion in limine, which we talked about several weeks ago, I think at this point, wanted to keep that all out of trial. He wanted to keep out the catch and kill. He wanted to keep out the doorman. He wanted to keep out Karen McDougal. And the judge, in ruling on that, held that their testimony qualifies under the Molyneux or Molyneux. How do you pronounce that in New York? That's a New York case. Molyneux?
It's like it's like either or either, or tomato and tomato.
Or Giglio or Giglio.
Giglio, exactly.
Giglio, yeah.
But can I just wait, two quick things? Woman one that we just heard the reference to from Mr. De Niro, that is Karen McDougal.
Exactly.
We've already heard about lawyer A, that is Michael Cohen. And to remind people, the reason that a statement of facts or an indictment uses those monikers and doesn't name them is because of a policy that prosecutors have that you don't denigrate people needlessly. You don't make accusations about them unless and until they are charged by a grand jury. So that is why those descriptors are used. Obviously, at trial, they're going to all be named because you're actually hearing evidence.
Right. It's not as though there was the suggestion that, you know, Ms. McDougal might be charged. It's just that, you know, you just anonymize oftentimes these kind of names in an indictment. But we digress here. So back to the motion that the judge had to determine. What the judge determined is that under this case, which is the same, essentially a case that establishes the same doctrine we have in federal law, which we've talked about under the rules of evidence, Rule 404B evidence, which is evidence of other crimes or wrongs. It is admissible for certain circumstances, right, to prove evidence of intent, motive, knowledge, absence of mistake, etc. And what the judge said, Judge Mershon, when he denied Trump's request to keep all of this out, he said, the steps taken to secure the stories of the doorman, although he referred to him by name, and McDougal complete the narrative of the agreement that was reached at the meeting, meaning the Trump Tower meeting that we heard about before the break. To wit, stemming the flow of negative information that could circulate about the defendant before it reaches the public eye. Locating and purchasing the information from Stormy Daniels not only completes the narrative of events that precipitated the falsification of business records, but is also probative of the defendant's intent and is inextricably intertwined with the narrative of the events and necessary background for the jury. So he's saying all of this comes in. It's inextricably intertwined into what ultimately happened in the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. It shows Mr. Trump's, it's probative of Mr. Trump's intent, and the jury's going to hear it. So I think that's really important because this is the entire theory of the case.
Yeah. And so what the judge is trying to do is say, I'm not letting this in for the impermissible purpose of showing propensity. In other words, you did A, so you're more likely to have done B. That
right.
You're something that you cannot argue, you cannot admit evidence for that. But he's saying that's not what it's for. This is like, you really can't understand the nature of the scheme if the jury thinks that it only happened once, that there's many, many times that this was going on and that you have to understand the nature of it. It would almost seem odd to a jury if they thought, oh, there's lots of bad information, but you're only doing this once. That doesn't make any sense. So it really does complete the picture of what they were about. I was going to make another point that I think is interesting to watch for the jury, because here, this is all sort of very much a precursor to the main event, which we're about to turn to, which is Stormy Daniels. But it's useful to remember that with respect to the allegations by the doorman, who we expect to be a witness, from Karen McDougal, who may also be a witness, and then from Stormy Daniels, who may also be a witness, the truth of what they have to say is not actually something that the jury has to find. In other words, you could imagine a scheme to suppress bad information and rumors and all sorts of negative information, regardless of whether it is true or not. Now, you may, in fact, if you do think it's true, it may be something that you have a sort of greater motive to try and suppress because it would be harder to refute. But it is not necessary for this scheme to work that the jury believe that, in fact, there was a tryst with Stormy Daniels or there was an affair with Karen McDougal, or that what the doorman said is true. In fact, I think that the state may say that they actually don't think that what the doorman was reporting was true.
That's
but
right.
None of that is relevant. And of course, Donald Trump has denied the Karen McDougal affair and the Stormy Daniels tryst. But that denial, well, the jury may choose to disbelieve the denial to the extent that it even comes into evidence that there is that denial, that it's not really technically relevant because you can still have this scheme whether these allegations are true or not. So keep an eye out for that. And that's one of the reasons, Mary, I'm going to be interested in something as to whether you did this. When I was picking a jury and I was confident in my case, and I thought I was only bringing a case because I thought there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I usually was confident in my case. I wanted the smartest jury possible. I don't mean just like, oh, they went to Princeton, not just academically smart. I meant that I wanted them to have common sense and seem like they were savvy and not going to be fooled. Because I thought if I'm right, what I really want is a jury that's going to be able to cut through arguments that don't hold water, are not logically sound. And so I always was looking for a smart jury. I don't know about you. What was your strategy?
That's my assessment as well, because you want them to analyze the facts and apply the law to those facts and not be swayed by things that I have seen happen. And I've sat on a jury myself, even as a lawyer before I was a prosecutor. I sat on a jury in a murder trial. And, you know, there were some, I will say, smoke and mirrors theories that the defense counsel tried to spin, which ultimately, as jurors, we saw right through it. But you want people who are going to not be swayed by, frankly, that case, the defense was a conspiracy theory and it had no legs. It had no evidence supporting it. But there were some jurors, until we started talking about it, who were kind of taken by that conspiracy theory. And once the other jurors started saying, well, what was the evidence of this conspiracy between two witnesses, basically, to frame the defendant? There just wasn't any. It was smoke and mirrors. So I agree with you on that.
So it's really interesting, by the way. I think that you and I need to have an entire episode where we compare our jury service, because, you know, I have a friend who said, you know, it's ridiculous. You worked on Enron, you worked on the special counsel Mueller case, you were the general counsel of the FBI. But with all of that, the case that I can speak the most about was the jury service I had for sort of an aggravated slip and fall. And by the way, I was on the jury a month after the Mueller investigation was over. I came back to New York and I thought there's no way they're going to pick
that.
Me for
wow.
a jury.
Okay.
And I did. So, okay. So that, I,
yes.
boy, you want to
Moving
talk
on.
About a digression. I could talk for way too long. And at some point, our producer is going to come in and be like, and we're done. So with that, I think it's time for us to move ahead and hear from Glenn Close. She is going to relate some more from the statement of facts about suppressing Woman 2's account. Remember, Woman 2 is Stormy Daniels. Here is the account read by the great actor, Glenn Close.
Suppressing Woman 2's account. About 1 month before the election, on or about October 7th, 2016, news broke that the defendant had been caught on tape saying to the host of Access Hollywood, quote, "I just start kissing them. Women. It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab them by the genitals. You can do anything." Unquote. The evidence shows that both the defendant and his campaign staff were concerned that the tape would harm his viability as a candidate and reduce his standing with female voters in particular. Shortly after the Access Hollywood tape became public, the AMI editor-in-chief contacted the AMI CEO about another woman, Woman 2, who alleged she had a sexual encounter with the defendant while he was married. The AMI CEO told the AMI editor-in-chief to notify Lawyer A. On or about October 10th, 2016, the AMI editor-in-chief connected Lawyer A with Woman 2's lawyer, Lawyer B. Lawyer A then negotiated a deal with Lawyer B to secure Woman 2's silence and prevent disclosure of the damaging information in the final weeks before the presidential election. Under the deal that Lawyer B negotiated, Woman 2 would be paid $130,000 for the rights to her account.
Mary, you know, I think everyone who's listening to this is going to remember where they were when they had news that this tape was out. For me, it has some additional significance because during the Mueller investigation, and I'm not saying this, I'm not doing the try your last case, and this isn't an anecdote. It actually relates to...
warning to listeners, this is not an anecdote.
Yeah, it's warning to listeners. It's not an anecdote. It's relevant information. I know, it's like I've become so much embroidery that I have to say, wait, it's not. within hours of the Access Hollywood tape coming out, and no coincidence, WikiLeaks put out the information and the internal emails and texts and information in the Hillary Clinton campaign, John Podesta emails. And there's a lot of background connective tissue to Roger Stone, to the Trump campaign. But it clearly was a way to say, look over here.
That's right. Distraction.
To change the narrative. And I think one of the things that we're going to learn about during this trial is I think we'll probably get evidence about the sort of the panic, not just within the Republican Party, but within the Trump campaign. And that is relevant to the information we just heard from Glenn Close about needing to quickly figure out how are they going to deal with the Stormy Daniels allegations? How do they squash that? How do we take immediate action so there isn't fuel on the fire after this very explosive tape was made public?
Yeah. And, you know, I love that reminder of what was happening, because if we take ourselves back to 2016, while all of these things are going on, this catch and kill operation, we also had, as you just indicated, these sort of, one might say, selective drops of information, emails and the like, that were reflected very negatively or were perceived to be reflecting negatively on Mr. Trump's opponent, Hillary Clinton. And we also had, during the same time, Trump famously saying, Russia, if you're listening, can you find the missing Hillary Clinton emails, right? So all of that effort to paint this picture of these candidates was going on that summer and that fall. And the other thing critical here, too, is that Access Hollywood tape dropped so close to the election, and it really was so explosive. It was on every TV station. It was all over social media. It was all over print news. And I will tell you, I actually thought it might actually be the end of Donald Trump. Boy, was I wrong. But that plus the Stormy Daniels allegations, particularly given that the allegations would involve an extramarital affair, you know, that's something that who knows whether it would have shifted voters' views, particularly, I think, female voters' views. But obviously, Mr. Cohen, Mr. Pecker thought it had the potential to do so. Otherwise, they would not have worried about it.
Right. That's the key, which is it's not necessary for the jury to say, oh, if this information came out, X would have happened. It's that they didn't want the risk of
that
happen. Right. They needed to lower the risk. I mean, remember, they don't know what's happening in the election. So they need to figure out, how do I denigrate the opposition? How do I rosy up and put lipstick on a pig with respect to the campaign, given that this had just come out? So, you know, in many ways, with all of Donald Trump talking about fake news, this trial may become sort of ground zero of, you know, Donald Trump fake news, both with respect to his own campaign and with respect to the Clinton campaign and also other Republican campaigns like Ted Cruz's. So I think that is something that's going to be fascinating, because we're going to really get a behind the scenes view, I think, during this trial. I don't think people quite realize that it's not like we already know everything that's going to be said. I think there's going to be a lot of details that I suspect will take all of us, you and me included, Mary, by surprise, in getting that kind of granular picture of what was going on.
Because there will be much more than what is actually in the statement of facts, right?
Yeah.
These selected excerpts, these are just the highlights, right?
Highlights.
With that, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will hear more of the statement of facts in the New York criminal case against Donald Trump.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Welcome back. So we've covered a lot so far, but now let's hear from Robert De Niro, who's going to continue to lay out events in the New York Statement of Facts, this time with respect to suppressing the Stormy Daniels account. Remember, woman two.
The defendant directed lawyer A to delay making a payment to woman two as long as possible. He instructed lawyer A that if they could delay the payment until after the election, they could avoid paying altogether, because at that point it would not matter if the story became public. As reflected in emails and text messages between and among lawyer A, lawyer B, and the AMI editor-in-chief, lawyer A attempted to delay making payment as long as possible. Ultimately, with pressure mounting and the election approaching, the defendant agreed to the payoff and directed lawyer A to proceed. Lawyer A discussed the deal with the defendant and the TO CFO. The defendant did not want to make the $130,000 payment himself and asked lawyer A and the TO CFO to find a way to make the payment. After discussing various payment options with the TO CFO, lawyer A agreed he would make the payment. Before making the payment, lawyer A confirmed with the defendant that defendant would pay him back. On or about October 26th, shortly after speaking with the defendant on the phone, lawyer A opened a bank account in Manhattan in the name of Essential Consultants, LLC, a new shell company he had created to effectuate the payment. He then transferred $131,000 from his personal home equity line of credit, HELOC, into that account. On or about October 27th, Lawyer A wired $130,000 from his Essential Consultants LLC account in New York to Lawyer B to suppress Woman 2's account.
Right. So here, I think, is where we really get to the heart of the charges in this case. What we've been leading up to so far is sort of the conspiracy, how we got to this place of having to hide these payments. If they'd have just made the payments, that would have been one thing, but it didn't end there, right? Here is where we see how we ended up with fraudulent business records. Rather than just have Mr. Trump just hand Stormy Daniels a bunch of cash, they wanted to make this look like some sort of legitimate business expense. And this is where we come up with the idea of Michael Cohen creating this shell company, Essential Consultants, opening a bank account for the shell company, and then from that shell company paying Stormy Daniels. But that's not all. And those payments, of course, became the invoices that got entered into the ledgers of the Trump Organization, right? So first set of falsified records, but the invoices weren't for payments to Stormy Daniels. The invoices were for legal services. There were no legal services taking place paying Stormy Daniels $130,000. The other thing is the invoices weren't just for a total of $130,000. They ended up being for a total of $420,000. The statement of facts make clear that figure they came up with by adding another $50,000 that Michael Cohen claimed that he was owed from Mr. Trump, coming up to $180,000, then just doubling that amount to $360,000 so that Lawyer A could call this legal services and income from legal services on his tax returns instead of a reimbursement. And of course, that had to cover what taxes he might owe on it. If it had been a reimbursement, he would be losing money. And then just adding some more to that to get up to a nice $420,000. So that's how we end up with 420,000. I think what's remarkable here is Michael Cohen then goes out and gets a personal home equity line of credit to put the original $130,000 into his account to pay Stormy Daniels. So lots of numbers here, lots of figures I've been throwing at you. But this is the crux of the false statements. We've got false invoices for legal services, false vouchers calling them legal services, and checks calling them legal services.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of intricacies to the scheme, but the bottom line is they made payoffs to Stormy Daniels. That's part of the catch and kill. And to make it clear that there's payments that didn't just write on them, hush money payments.
Right.
The whole point is to keep this hush and or hush hush. So the paperwork denominated this all as legal fees. And the problem in that is if you're going to call it legal fees, as Michael Cohen realized, if they're legal fees, he has to pay taxes on it, meaning he's owed more money by Trump in the reimbursements because if he has to pay taxes on it,
thus
he's
the doubling, right?
Exactly. And by the way, that's how there's going to be proof that Donald Trump knew this was also going to have a tax fraud component because he's paying more than just the $130,000 and some little bit to Michael Cohen, so that intricacy and that amount over 130 is going to be really good proof for the state's going to point to as to his intent that this also was going to involve a tax fraud.
And that's critical because that's what makes...
That's one of the theories for why this is a felony, not a misdemeanor. Absolutely.
Yeah, and because remember, there's three underlying crimes that are possibilities for Alvin Bragg to prove that Mr. Trump had an intent to conceal a crime. Alvin Bragg doesn't have to prove those crimes beyond a reasonable doubt, doesn't have to charge those crimes, but he has to show that Trump was intending to conceal other crimes. And that's based on exactly what we just talked about, tax fraud. It's based on violations of New York elections law and violations of federal campaign finance law. And we'll talk more about those when we get to that in the trial.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun thing. By the way, this is where I always wanted to have this be called. I haven't said this in a while, which is I always thought this podcast was going to be called like Two Nerds Talking.
Yeah.
Like the reason we're so excited about that is because it's going to be like super in the weeds as to like the intricacies of the law. But I'll make a point that's actually much less in the weeds. One of the things that I really love about the piece that Robert De Niro just read is something really smart, which is the very first thing that he read said, the defendant directed lawyer A to delay making a payment to woman two as long as possible. He instructed lawyer A that if they could delay the payment until after the election, they could avoid paying altogether. Now, why is that? Because after the election, he may not have to pay at all because
he's already the president.
He's either already the president or he's lost.
Or not.
So he's either won or he's lost, but he doesn't have to pay anymore. A defense in this case is that he was doing this only to keep this from his wife. It wasn't to keep it from anyone else. That's not a total defense, by the way, to false business records. But this is making it clear that that's not what was going on. If this evidence comes in and is believed, this is clear allegations that, oh, he didn't care about this information coming out and it being kept from Melania. This is, according to the DA, information about he's so cheap that he's like, you know what? I may have to pay this money.
And it shows it was all about keeping it from the voters, right? And I actually think this, if this comes out at trial, is one of the most significant, besides the entire scheme, sort of one of the most significant statements that will support proof of his intent.
So, Mary, there is so much by the minute going on. We will have the end of the jury selection, and we may very well, the next time we're together, talk about one of the things that I think will be sort of the most enjoyable and I hope actually the most profitable for our listeners, which is our listening to the openings. And that's where I do think that your expertise in terms of being a trial lawyer, I won't say that about
myself. Yours too. You tried more cases than I did. I probably handled more appeals, but you tried more cases.
Oh, totally. Are you kidding? I always need appellate lawyers, you know, even now in the podcast. I just think that's going to be a really interesting part to see strategically what both sides are focusing on and how they are pitching their narratives.
Agree, 100%.
To the jury.
I can hardly believe that with only just two more courtroom days, I think we're going to be in a very different place by next Tuesday.
Absolutely. We'll continue to bring you new episodes twice a week to keep you up to speed in the New York trial. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back to you very shortly. The show is produced by Vicky Vergolina. Our associate producer is Jamaris Perez. Catherine Anderson and Bob Mallory are our audio engineers. A special thanks to Glenn Close and Robert De Niro for reading from the statement of facts in the New York indictment. Our head of audio production is Bryson Barnes. Aisha Turner is the executive producer for MSNBC Audio. And Rebecca Cutler is the senior vice president for content strategy at MSNBC. Search for Prosecuting Donald Trump wherever you get your podcasts, and please follow the series.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.